30th with Lee Noble, local artist. Super stoked for that. It's going to be a good one. Yeah, so definitely circle back, as they say here on KFAI, next week, Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. And stick around as well today after the show for Right on Radio. Thanks so much. Take care.
When you're ready to let go of that car you no longer need, KFAI is ready for you. Our vehicle donation program is available 7 days a week to help you arrange for your free pickup. It's easy, it's free, and it matters. Donate at kfai.careasy.org or call 855-277-2346.
Support for KFAI comes in part from First Avenue, presenting Space Monkey Mafia and Left on 10th at the Turf Club Wednesday, July 29th. Minneapolis's own Space Monkey Mafia is rooted in 90s and 2000s ska and punk, infused with a healthy dose of contemporary influences, lyrical urgency, and a message to meet the moment. Co-headlining this show is Left on 10th. Opening the show is Sunshine and the Nightwalkers. More information about Space Monkey Mafia and Left on 10th at the Turf Club is available at first-avenue.com.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org, the community's true voice.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to KFAI 90.3 and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. This is Right on Radio, and I'm your host tonight, Emma. This is the show where we talk about local, national, and international authors, about their craft, creativity, and the ideas about their writing. Our guest tonight is Ali Fard and his newly released book from University of Minnesota Press, Grounding the Cloud, Urbanism in the Shadow of Data. Me and Ali discuss about data centers and the urban cost of the quote-unquote tech cloud. And then afterwards, in the past half hour, we will go back into the archives and re-listen to my discussion with Matthew Thompson and his book on life support. Stay tuned for Right on Radio. So much today for listeners at home. My name is Emma. I'm the co-host right now of Right on Radio. My special guest today is Ali Fard and their new recently released book, Grounding the Cloud, Urbanism in the Shadow of Data. Thank you so much for being here tonight.
This is a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So can you just give out a brief overview about you? Like, how did you get into, what is your title, your current profession? I'm really curious.
So I'm currently an assistant professor of architecture at the University of Virginia. I've been in that role since 2018. And before that, I was teaching at the University of Waterloo and up in Canada. And a lot of my work and research revolves around looking at infrastructure, really kind of understanding its spatial imprints and the urban imprints of large technical systems, right, and how they manifest themselves physically. And I've been, you know, doing that for a long time, much longer than I would like to admit, but specifically dealing with kind of digital networks, it's been since, I would say since 2010 that I became really interested in understanding the spaces of information technologies and data mm-hmm. technologies, what they entail, what are the issues that that are at the core of it. Because I saw that no one was really looking at that time. This is before the hype around data centers and all of that. So it was a good opportunity to begin to look at this underlying network of contemporary urban life and really understand its spaces and all of that.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the title of the book, Grounding the Cloud. And really a big portion of the introduction is just defining what the cloud is. Do you mind just giving up your definition of what the cloud is? I know it's a bit of an ask.
It is, particularly because different people define the cloud differently, right? And that's part of the first half of the book is all about how do we define the cloud spatially, right? Because you could, if you look at it technically, you could kind of define the cloud based on its network connections and the ability for elastic kind of growth over time and all of these kind of technical conditions. But that takes us away from the fact that there is a very heavy spatial footprint to the cloud, and that idea of it being this amorphous blob of data out in the skies that we just kind of dump our cat photos and kids' photos and everything onto. It takes away from our really critical understanding of it as a spatial condition, as something that is dependent on a lot of material geographies, extraction, data mining, all of that. But also it's a condition that is producing a lot of new spatial conditions. And this is where my focus on data center comes about. Yeah. But also, I think we can expand our definition of the cloud beyond just data centers, because typically that's how people define the cloud. Cloud and data centers have become almost synonymous. But to me, it includes transmission lines. It includes fiber optic networks. It includes even the extraction sites of a lot of the precious metals that go into our data devices, as well as the command and control centers of data technologies, whether those are the technology campuses of high-tech companies or the smart city initiatives that has become a kind of almost like a parallel buzzword to the cloud for a lot of urbanists, this idea of smart urbanism. So I kind of look at it holistically. This idea of the cloud and spatializing it entails looking at this multitude of scales and multitude of geographies.
I want to kind of touch on when you mentioned smart cities. That was the one thing that I took away quite a bit from this book. Also, I'm going to make a little bit of a side. One of my favorite figures in your book is figure four, when you just Google the cloud. And it's just like what you mentioned, though, is it's like this very cartoonish, like you're divorced away from the environmental urbanism impact of these data centers. But let's go kind of round that back out to what is a smart city? And like, can you just kind of give an overview of our listeners at home, what that exactly kind of means?
Like the cloud, the idea of smart city is very complex. And again, like depending on who you talk to and what expertise they have, they will probably define it a little bit differently. But to me, and where it becomes important in relationship to the cloud, is a smart city at its core is a technologically decked out city, right? right. It's a city that or it's an urban condition that really quantifies or tries to quantify a lot of the dynamics that typically happen in cities, from traffic to water flow to infrastructural usage and even the condition of roadways and all of that, right? And by quantifying it, it actually creates, or again, attempts to create this monitoring system that is meant to make urban life and urban management very efficient, right? Very quick, In actuality, and this is what I get into in the book as well, it misses on the fact that a lot of our cities, a lot of the urban conditions that we inhabit on a daily basis, operate based on tensions, right? And operate based on inefficiencies these kind of moments that don't fit very nicely into data models, right? Or cannot be quantified. So in essence, it ends up being a system that is meant to be very closed, right? So it defines a finite set of parameters for its operation for a condition that is not at all finite. Right. Yeah. And it's kind of very fuzzy, right? Even how we define a city has become questioned and as a result. So, and a lot of the proponents of the smart city kind of put it in conversation with the alternative. Like, no one wants a dumb city, right? Yeah. I don't know anyone that would be like, you know, I would love to live in a dumb city.
Yeah.
So even in the language that they use, there is this kind of progressive ideology at the core of it, which is also part of this kind of emergence of the image of the cloud, that technology is really the end all and be all of this kind of response to this kind of increasingly complex urban condition that we are dealing with, and anything other than that is dumb, right?
Yeah, I always think about, like, if I'm thinking of, like, a smart city, I always think of, like, my head goes to immediately to when I had a friend that bought a house and they wanted a smart sink. And the idea was you would say, hey, pour me a cup of water to the smart sink with, like, a Bluetooth and chip device.
Right.
And it would pour them a cup of water into, like, a cooking thing. And I'm like, I can't handle how everything has, like, a Bluetooth or smart. But in terms of, like, technology and, like, kind of this inherent idea of progressivism, it's just like, oh, if you're not with the technology, if you're resistant to it, you are backwards, not progressive. Do you touch a little bit about that in the book as much? Or if you want to kind of elaborate more on your thoughts on that?
Yeah, a little bit, especially when it comes to this idea of smart city, and especially in relationship to technological systems and infrastructural systems. That's where I also get into the ideology of progress that's always embedded in these systems. Even if we go back to the 19th century, the idea of kind of infrastructural development, this kind of modern ideology of development that was creating this kind of very efficient system of bringing materials and flows into the city and really kind of translating those natural flows into urban flows, right, was really based on this kind of progressive ideology that technology can respond to a lot of these kind of social, political issues, right, just by being, I mean, in this contemporary sense, by being pseudo-objective, really position themselves as these kind of apolitical response to these urban dynamics that they're monitoring on a kind of an ongoing basis. Whereas we know everything about technology, its development, everything about infrastructure and its development is highly political, right? And they tend to, this idea of the image of the smart city or the image of the cloud tends to sweep under the rug those tensions, those kind of the messiness that's a very active part of contemporary urban life, and instead give us this kind of very efficient, very cool, very kind of simple and singular idea of the cloud, right? So we don't have to really think about the complexities.
What I would like to kind of touch upon now is the role of giant tech companies in this, from Amazon to Meta to Google. The one thing that, when I was going through this book, I almost kind of forgot about it, was like the Amazon 2 headquarters debacle, because I'm going to be honest, I was a little too young to care. But I remember I lived in Pittsburgh at the time, and that was one of the contending cities. And I just remember the debate about, like, oh, Amazon's going to come in gentrify, build these huge compounds, and people were very happy or very unhappy, depending on the political spectrum. So I'm wondering if you could kind of touch a little bit about that, because that was one thing I was like, oh, I kind of forgot about that.
Yeah, that is actually like a whole chapter of the book is about these moments of concentration, what I call them, as these kind of moments where the ideologies and the forces around technological development take on a really urban form. We see that in technology campuses themselves, and how those ideologies begin to bleed out of the campus and into the rest of the city, right, or the surrounding urban environments. And this goes back to 2017, I believe, was when Amazon put out this kind of call for cities to bid to be the hosts for its second headquarters, which was really interesting, particularly because how desperate cities were.
Yeah, they were.
To really court Amazon.
Like the amount of tax breaks, and it's just like, come here.
It's
like,
wild.
I remember like the ads. It's like, oh, we're going to have the, in Pittsburgh specifically, I remember, it's like, oh, we have the knowledge from Carnegie Mellon, from University of Pittsburgh.
Right.
We have this. It's just like, we'll basically roll out the red carpet for Amazon headquarters and kind of ignore any sort of maybe urban downsides to having a giant tech company live in your backyard.
Absolutely. And a lot of that, I mean, there's a long history of this idea of cities and governments providing incentives for technology companies, or, you know, it used to be factories and manufacturing economy back in the day, but now technology companies. Because the idea is that it kind of, you know, spurts economic development. It helps with new jobs, right? So it is looked at as an engine for development. Mm-hmm. But the kind of the chorus of desperation that formed around this Amazon call was really depressing, but also exciting, because you really did sense that something is changing. There is this kind of power dynamics that's shifting towards technology companies. Now they have a lot of say about what happens in cities, what happens in neighborhoods, right? Because if they're bringing in billions of dollars of construction, as well as 50,000 high-paying jobs, they're going to expect a lot in return, right? Yeah. And that exerts a lot of new flows and new dynamics into conditions that might not be best suited for that, right? So urbanistically, it becomes an issue. But also it was part of, like, I look at 2017 as this kind of watershed moment where there is this kind of transference of power happening between urban governance and technology companies, because that was the same year that Sidewalk Labs, which is a subsidiary of, or used to be a subsidiary of Google, also went around shopping for cities to host its kind of smart city experiments, right, and smart city ideas. And they ended up in Toronto, Sidewalk Toronto was a massive project that ultimately didn't go through, and it paralleled Amazon's search for its second headquarters, which also was very problematic. At the end, they ended up picking Northern Virginia and Queens, I believe, in New York as the site. So they were gonna just, you know, do two headquarters. And there was a lot of resistance. They got a lot of resistance from local communities in Queens. And, you know, as soon as they saw that, they were like, yeah, we're canceling that project and we're only going with Northern Virginia. And that was very similar to what happened in Toronto, where with all the hoopla around this kind of, you know, new this tech company coming in, really revolutionizing urbanism of Toronto, or at least that part of the city on the waterfront, When the pandemic hit, they used that as a, as an excuse to cancel the project, right? And really, to me, at least, it shows the fact that these tech companies are the worst stewards of of public infrastructure and public urban management because they're not responsible to the public. They're responsible only to their shareholders. And it kind of creates this really tense relationship between people that they are supposed to serve and people that are going whose data they're extracting and whose benefits are not being received by those same people, and it only goes to their shareholders.
So I want to talk about data centers now, because that's the hot topic. I've been noticing, especially in the public sphere, when we talk about AI generative images, more data and for more computational work, is it feels like for a lot of this, especially the suburban areas here in the Twin Cities, there's data centers being built or proposed to these more smaller suburban areas, and a lot of community pushback. And that's kind of where I want to talk about, where it's like, are we kind of, like we titled the book, Grounding the Cloud. Now we're kind of realizing, hey, there is an urban cost, there is a mining cost. And it's not some obscure mine, you know, somewhere in rural areas. It's in your backyard now. Do you think like there's kind of a nexus, another nexus point with these data centers that you see as a parallel to the Amazon headquarters as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So when I said urban initiatives of tech companies are one pole in the discussion, right? They are very concentrated, very visible, typically within already existing urban environments. There is an extended part to that, right? Which is the data centers, the fiber optic cable networks, the mining sites, right? So what I term the territorial instruments, because even though they're a little bit outside of our typical spatial consciousness, they still very important infrastructures for clouds to define where their territory is, right? And really define the boundaries of their influence and all of that. But increasingly, these projects are beginning to kind of enter into people's consciousness, because I mean, on one hand, you see the actual cost of it, like the economic cost of it, like people in Northern Virginia, which is a region that I look at a lot as part of the book, people are seeing the difference in their utility bills, right? The data centers have used since 2019 2/3 more water, right? So water usage has gone up, and this is in the context of extreme drought that we're having in the state right now, right? So people are kind of coming to an understanding that there are real consequences, real and immediate consequences to having these kind of behemoths of technology in your backyard. But I would also argue that there is another side that we're not paying as much attention to. The low-hanging fruits are energy usage and water usage. A lot of people talk about that. But I would argue that spatial impacts, right, and how they impact the quality of life, right, and their immediate surroundings and regionally, is a condition that's not looked at enough as this kind of as the driver of these critical understandings of the impacts of data centers. And that's what I try to do a little bit in the book, is to also understand the spatial impacts and the urban impacts of these infrastructures, which we see on a day-to-day basis, as an important part of really outlining their ultimate impacts on our lives.
They're massive. They're just massive. it kind of reminds me of the first time when I went to the Bay Area specifically, and I saw Apple headquarters for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I was overwhelmed. And one, it looks like a spaceship, and it kind of freaked me out. And it just takes up an entire, like, 3 or 4 blocks of that area. And just I don't know, I'm always flabbergasted by like how big these are, because I always think it's like, okay, like I can conceptually hear like, okay, I can see like on my favorite figure in your book is figure 25, is this like that right. whole entire mining process of cobalt and lithium to the batteries in my phone currently. Sure. So that's one of my favorite figures in general. I think it's a really great layout of the environmental cost. So like I can conceptually think about this, but to see like a mine in person is kind of jarring in a way. It's like, oh, that's massive. I didn't realize like how big this is consumer level. And I do think, I'm kind of curious what you think like the future of data centers are going to be moving forward in 2026.
I think it's interesting that you bring up the Apple headquarters, because like data centers, these are objects that are only discernible if you look at them from satellite views, yeah. right? Or from aerial photos. That's when you see the donuts, you see yeah. the circle of the Apple headquarters. That's when you see the data center as this kind of object in a typically agricultural kind of surrounding area. But when you walk by it, like it takes some of the larger data centers in Northern Virginia, it takes 10 minutes to walk the length of one of them, right? And they typically come with multiples in a data center campus. So I think the impact that has to urban connectivity, to urban fragmentation is massive, and it's something that we can't ignore. But ultimately the future model of data center development needs to change, because we are kind of coming against the very fundamental limits to the growth of the current model, right? We're running out of space, we're running out of resources, and increasingly there is a lot of community backlash, rightfully so, for having these kind of data centers in your backyard. And to me, a lot of that makes sense. And so a lot of these frictions are going to have to be responded to with new models of data center development, right? And one thing that we've been starting to look at has been the idea of consolidation, mm-hmm. right? Because typically the way that we develop data centers in the US are these kind of single story, massive footprint buildings that just kind of extend forever into the landscape. But what does it mean to concentrate that? What does it mean to consolidate a number of data centers into one? Is there efficiencies that come with that? Also, that means that you're putting less of a burden on kind of the surrounding urban environment, right? At least theoretically, right? It needs to be studied. And another immediate future for data center and the discussion around that has to do with policies that we currently don't have to deal with data centers. I don't know any kind of urban center that has specific regulations or specific policies geared towards data centers, right? There is emerging discussions around, I think a town in California just passed the moratorium on new data center development, which is great to see. But we are going to see more policy apparatus and mechanisms and frameworks that come online to respond to the massive and rapid growth of data centers, especially in places like Northern Virginia, which, as you might know, it's the largest and densest kind of data center market in the world, right?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ali, for this lovely conversation. Mm-hmm. And now Ali's going to read an excerpt from his book, Grounding the Cloud. So if you don't mind taking a read from your...
Absolutely. And this is just for your listeners. This is a few passages from the introduction to the book. And I think it kind of hopefully gives a good idea about what's in the book and what you can expect from it. There we go. On a recent bike trip along a Northern Virginia trail, two distinct but intertwined soundscapes complemented the rhythm of my pedaling. There was the typical buzzing of the cicadas that signals summer in these parts of the country, and then there was the constant humming of the many data centers that surround the trail. Some local residents have likened the sound to being on an airport runway with an operating airplane engine, except that the airplane keeps idling and never leaves. The Washington and Old Dominion Trail, along which I was pedaling, forms an unofficial spine for the technical landscapes of logistics and data that have, over the past few decades, become some of the strongest economic drivers of Northern Virginia. There are currently more than 25 million square feet of data centers in operation in Loudoun County alone, with another 4 million in development. This is the infrastructural landscape that underwrites the rapid expansion of artificial intelligence and bolsters the growth of smart cities. This is where the cloud meets the ground. Back on the trail, I was struck by how mundane everything felt. The almost overwhelming fragmentation visible in the aerial views of the region is not as noticeable when one is cruising along the trail's right of way. The trail passes by parks, backyards, and golf courses. It goes above and under state highways and alongside roads. If it were not for the occasional glimpses of the massive football field-sized data centers that huddle along its path and whose walls poke above the dense greenery lining its borders, the trail would feel almost idyllic. This ordinary spatial condition is characteristic of data technologies. They are often just under the surface, in a closet, behind trees, beyond the fence, or inside windowless buildings. And this is how we experience them. They slip in and out of our spatial consciousness. Spaces of data technology mingle and meld into everyday spaces. They become infrastructure, the enabling and productive backdrop of the revolution in digital technologies, and the key to the emergence of contemporary data economy. This is a book about technology. It is also about urbanization. More precisely, the book is concerned with the complex and intertwined relationship between the rapid expansion of data technologies and the changing patterns of urbanization. It is an exploration of the emerging spatial footprint of data, where ideologies, marketing images, and economic models meet the grounded reality of materials, space, and the urban. From sensors to data centers, from undersea cables to the informal cobalt mines of sub-Saharan Africa, and from high-tech campuses to the so-called smart cities dotting the globe, the productive landscape of data are heavily informed by the politics of material and space. The need to command this global geography and control the precious data it mediates has given rise to the emergence of spatial configurations and organizational models intertwined with patterns of urbanization that have accelerated since the mid-20th century. I argue that in this context, the centralizing ethos of cloud computing and the rise of technology platforms are espousing a particular territorial project. One that positions data-driven control and management of concentrated moments of urbanization in cities in direct relation to infrastructural expansion and the increasing operationalization of the erstwhile non-urban periphery. Through what I term territorial instruments, tech platforms delineate their territory and extend their reach into almost every corner of the globe, while a machinery of myth, marketing, represents this complex geography as a singular, clean, objective, efficient, and transformative platform. In this reterritorialization of the periphery, the buildup of computing resources and the enclosure of material geographies that are often situated outside of major population centers contribute as much to the socio-technical construction of technology platforms as do their corporate headquarters and their smart city initiatives, where architecture and urbanism are co-opted to give form to the techno-positivistic ideologies of platforms. This proposition raises a new set of questions regarding not only how we perceive the spatial impacts of platforms and the cloud, but also how we comprehend the processes of contemporary urbanization. Ultimately, by problematizing the normative reading of urban space within discussions of technology, the various chapters of the book collectively peel back the transcendent veneer of tech urbanism, revealing how data clouds are firmly tethered to the messy geopolitics and uneven material geographies of global urbanization. Hope that's helpful.
Thank you. This is wonderful. I am really excited for this book. This is one of my favorite reads currently this year. Thank you so much, Ali Fard, for your recently released book, Grounding the Cloud, Urbanism in the Shadow of Data, released from the University of Minnesota Press.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Support for KFAI comes in part from First Avenue, presenting Pearl and the Oysters at the Turf Club, Wednesday, July 15th. International space age retro futurist jazz pop adventurers Pearl and the Oysters are touring with their latest release, Monkey Mind, an album that sees them bend our already surreal daily life through their heightened psychedelic prism. From bossa nova to psychedelic surf and turf to electro polka, Pearl and the Oysters give off a natural high vibe. More information about Pearl and the Oysters live at the Turf Club is available at first-avenue.com.
The 20th Annual Bayfront Reggae and World Music Festival, Saturday, July 18th. Duluth's Bayfront Festival Park hosts this family-friendly, all-ages event whose artists spread the message of love, hope, and equality for all people worldwide. This year's 20th anniversary lineup includes Protégé, Jesse Royal, TJ, Libyanka, Rick Jam, Sound of Fusion, and the International Reggae All-Stars. Music, food, and positive vibes. All next to the scenic bay in Duluth. More information about the 20th Annual Bayfront Reggae and World Music Festival is available at bayfrontworldmusic.com.
So my follow-up question for this was, what kind of research did you do for this kind of book? Because I'm looking at like, oh, there's some cool old menus. There's a lot of cool photos in the book. What was like that process to like? Was it kind of easy to find these kind of portions of media? Was it a little bit difficult? Where did you look?
It was fantastic research, by the way. I mean, I traveled to France. I interviewed a whole bunch of people. That was fantastic. There was a lot of, sort of archival type research as well. And compared to my previous book, okay, this is my third book. My previous book was called Ritz and Escoffier, and it was about the late 19th century. And that really was, well, first of all, obviously completely archival. You can't talk to anyone. And the archives are quite buried. I mean, you'd think, okay, London in the late 19th century had a thriving press. There was multiple newspapers and, you know, huge amounts of articles being written every day, including about the Savoy Hotel and the people that I was researching. But finding those articles was quite difficult, whereas, writing about the 60s and 70s, it's much more accessible. So yeah, there was quite a bit of archival research looking into newspapers and then also interviewing people. As I started the process, I thought, okay, I'm going to be interviewing these Nouvelle Cuisine chefs, the famous, most of them, a lot of them had died, but Michel Girard was still alive, Pierre Troigros was still alive, two of the main sort of iconic figures, and I did interview them. As I was doing the research, I discovered there was this group of women chefs who came up at the same time in the 70s and who were barred from joining the Association of French Chefs and various other sort of bureaucratic institutions that safeguarded French cuisine. They were not allowed entry. And so they created their own organization called the ARC in the mid 70s to promote women chefs and women cooking and women's kitchens and so forth. And a lot of those women were still alive. And so I trekked around France interviewing them as well. And that's sort of, that's another level of the story. That's also why I call it the secret history. I mean, Nouvelle Cuisine is not a secret. Yeah. I feel like it's been sort of misconstrued, but the story of these women chefs and the ARC is a secret. No one really remembers that or knows about that. So that was my research. It was a combination of archival stuff, interviews in France. And also here too, by the way. I mean, my book does not entirely take place in France. There's a whole component in the States. I interviewed Ruth Reichel or various other people here in the States who remembered, what happened in the 70s. And so, yeah, interviews and archival research. Yeah.
So I also wanted to talk a little bit about the portion that goes back to the States, because the first thing that I think of in like this kind of movement as an American, my first thought is the farm to table movement, definitely in California. Does that have like a parallel relationship with the Nouvelle Cuisine? Do you think like Nouvelle Cuisine in France kind of sparked it, or is it like?
I think that's connected. I mean, it's the same time. If you think back to, I don't know, Chez Panisse, Alice Waters, early 1970s, there's a kind of like, first of all, Alice Waters was not a trained chef. You know, now that, compare that to the men of in the French haute cuisine kitchens. They were all super trained, like they've been training as apprentices since they were teenagers. It was a highly regimented, you know, system. This was the system that the women chefs I was just talking about were excluded from. If you were a young woman in France in the 70s, early 70s, and you wanted to go do an apprenticeship at the Trois Gras restaurant, for example, you couldn't, because it was men only. So Alice Waters was not a trained chef. She opened that restaurant. There was a kind of, you know, post-60s, a little bit of a hippie vibe going on in California around that. And that is connected to this Nouvelle Cuisine moment, this kind of liberating, trying to liberate cooking and liberate the kitchen from all of these strictures. And in fact, you know, there's a little side. One of the people that I interviewed for this book was a man named Billy Cross, who had worked, his boyfriend had worked. Michael James was his boyfriend. He was working at Chez Panisse. And this was in the early 70s. They were, they decided to start a cooking school together up in Northern California. And they would invite these great French chefs over to the States to teach these 1 week long, very extravagant cooking classes on a winery in Napa. And so there was definitely a connection between that kind of California cool, new cooking, farm to table, everything seasonal, everything fresh. That was definitely kind of philosophically, culturally connected to the Nouvelle Cuisine movement. You know, Nouvelle Cuisine, the philosophy of Nouvelle Cuisine was absolutely the same. It was about freshness and seasonality and experimentation and just a kind of more freewheeling feeling in the kitchen. So absolutely.
What I also noticed in the book, one of my favorite was like the diet fad a little bit, and especially like putting calories on a menu.
Yep.
And I didn't realize, like for me, like, oh, that was because like the health department in the U.S. kind of mandated that. But that seemed to be, did you think that was like idea, like this?
Yeah. Nouvelle Cuisine, you know, one of the things that it was experimenting with was it was healthier. It was fresher. You know, the food was fresh. The food was healthy. They were very, very scornful, for example, of covering up a piece of meat or a piece of fish with some incredibly rich, heavy sauce, which was, you know, the cliche of French haute cuisine. You'd go to the restaurant, you have your sole, your fish, and then there would be a sauce. They were absolutely against sauces. They were against these thick, rich sauces. And so it became, and you have to think back to this moment in the early mid 70s. This was a moment when people were, I mean, I remember I grew up, I mean, I was a child, a small child in the early 70s, but I remember my parents my mom was baking bread in, you know, for us. And buying food at the food co-op in Berkeley, California, and this was all part of the kind of the in the back in the ether at the time. I do think there's a connection there.
What I also thought, like the difference between Nouvelle Cuisine, before haute cuisine, was like the role of the critic, and I wonder if you could talk about like the role of the critic in terms of food consumption, media, and how did they play a role in the chef's
life? Yeah, I mean, it's interesting also to think about how, you know, there have always been, or in the post-war period, there were restaurant critics at major newspapers, let's say. Craig Claiborne at the New York Times was like the godfather, the dean of the American food world. and he wrote restaurant reviews for the New York Times. But he was pretty much the only one. No, there were maybe a few others. And in France, it was the same. There was, you know, there was Robert Courtine at Le Monde, who was the all-powerful food critic. And by the way, the villain of my book, fascinating character. Always good to have a villain in a story like this. But this also, this moment of Nouvelle Cuisine is also the time when the kind of food, publicity around food was invented. Go and Mio were two French newspaper writers who cottoned onto this at the time and realized food and restaurants were hot. People were talking about new restaurants. This was exciting. They, in fact, coined the idea of Nouvelle Cuisine. They wrote a manifesto in their magazine saying, this is what Nouvelle Cuisine is. Here are the 10 commandments of Nouvelle Cuisine. It should always be fresh, no more heavy sauces, et cetera, all the rules, quote unquote, rules of Nouvelle Cuisine. And this was a glossy magazine, hugely successful magazine. You know, the food magazine, what are the top 10 bistros in Lyon? Where should I go? What are the new restaurants in Paris? All this kind of stuff. And they were taking on the kind of hegemonic Michelin guide, which was this, had been around forever. The Michelin guide, basically is a listing of restaurants, and the only editorial in that book is the star system. So they have, you can be listed without a star, or you can have 1, 2, or 3 stars. That's the Michelin system, and that's it. It lists if you're a great restaurant and you're listed in the Michelin guide, it just lists the address of the restaurant, and it lists how many stars you got, and it might list, okay, here is the items on the menu that are specialties of the house, kind of thing, and that's it. There's no writing. There's no voice. There's no attitude. Go and Mio decided we're going to create a guidebook that's going to compete with the Michelin guide, but it's going to be fun. It's going to have attitude. It's going to have opinions, and that's what they brought to it. So that was very, very much a product again of this moment in the culture of the late 60s, early 70s, where food became part of the popular culture in a way. And another character that I wrote about in my book and interviewed and who was absolutely wonderful is Yanou Kolar. She invented the idea of the publicity, the PR person for a restaurant, mm-hmm. which hadn't really existed until then. And so she represented a lot of these chefs and got them great publicity. And, you know, Paul Bocuse is on the cover of Newsweek magazine in the 70s, all this kind of publicity. She was, and she was very connected in Hollywood as well. And, you know, was one of the sort of people promoting the idea that chefs, not that chefs should be celebrities, but that there was a kind of glamour attached to being a chef. And that's sort of the shift that had happened. She was part of making that happen.
And that's like something that we see today. Guy Fieri is like definitely more of a comical take, but like Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah,
definitely the trend that we still see today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the origins of our kind of food media complex go back to this. At the end of my book, I introduced the idea. This is in the 80s. Paul Bocuse created the Bocuse d'Or, which was his idea was cooking should, it would be like an Olympics of cooking. So you would have national teams, the American team, the Swiss team, the German team, whatever. These teams would all come to Lyon, which is where he was based. And they would, and this would happen every few years. It wouldn't be every year. And they would compete they would be given challenges like, okay, you have 1 hour to create the dinner with this chicken and these ingredients or whatever it was. So this is like, you know, and now again, our culture is just, you know, everywhere you look, there's a food cooking competition on television. But this was new. This was something that also goes back to this period where the cooking became part of the culture in that way.
I'm thinking of like Gordon Ramsay's like very Americanized, very yelly kind of American show. But I'm like, that's mm-hmm. always get a kick out of that one. But my next follow-up question is, especially when your book talks about like the underdogs, the women, do you think mm-hmm. novella cuisine, like kind of that philosophy, also kind of correlated with women's liberation in the movement, especially in the 70s?
Yeah, well, I think the ARC, which was the group of women chefs that I write about, who were excluded from these institutions, the organization of French chefs or whatever, they were excluded. They were definitely influenced by, they weren't super political. They were just women who ran restaurants who wanted to be recognized for what they were doing. But at the same time, the leader of the Nouvelle Cuisine movement was Paul Bocuse. Paul Bocuse was like the most famous of all of these chefs. He was the guy who was, first and foremost, he was the guy who was on the cover of Newsweek or whatever. And he was just a classic French chauvinist, like the kind of guy who would say, he was a very charming, flirtatious guy, but he loved to say things like, women can't cook. You know, I'd rather have a woman in my bed than, you know, in the kitchen. This kind of like slightly sarcastic 1950s style sexism came very naturally to him. And he was, you know, he relished being the provocateur. He saw himself as kind of a rogue. He had many mistresses. He had illegitimate children, all this kind of, this was his whole persona. And of course, as soon as the women of the ARC, when the women started this organization, the ARC, he immediately started attacking it, sort of half in jest, but also half seriously. You know, why are the women, for example, the women of the ARC posed in Paris Match magazine wearing their wearing white chef's toques, you know, the chef's hat, which they didn't normally wear, but for the photo shoot they did. And Paul Bocuse wrote a letter after he saw that saying, how dare these women use the toque? The toque is only for men. You know, it was tongue in cheek, but it was also trying to be provocative. So absolutely, the politics are complicated. I mean, let's just say that at the outset, because I already referred briefly to Robert Courtine, the villain of my story, who's like an arch conservative. He's the powerful food critic. He hates Nouvelle Cuisine because Nouvelle Cuisine is experimental and Nouvelle Cuisine is breaking the rules and Nouvelle Cuisine is not the kind of old school French cooking that he likes. And he latches onto the women of the ARC and says, these women, these are this is the kind of cooking I like. So it's a complicated situation where you have these women who are sort of, yes, pursuing a women's liberation, pursuing a kind of feminist approach, trying to get recognized for and be allowed to create their own organization. And eventually, by the way, they are allowed to join the chef organization sometime in the 80s. It takes a while. But they have allied themselves with this very conservative guy who has a dark history. You know, he's basically a fascist, which the truth about him sort of slowly trickles out over the course of the 70s and 80s. And that's a big part of the story that I'm telling too. So it's not a simple, story of Nouvelle Cuisine was good or bad. It was definitely a reflection of this time of experimentation, and it coincided with these women chefs who were also doing experimenting and opening, trying new dishes and. And so, you know, it's the political story is a little bit of a complicated one, but very fun to write about.
The one kind of couple more questions, and then Luke here will do us a little reading from his book. Where do you think the future of French cooking is going to land now, post Nouvelle, and then like into the 21st century onwards?
People ask me this. I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. I think, you know, what happened was, okay, so Nouvelle Cuisine is in the 1970s. There's been much more recently, if you think back to, like the Noma restaurant, for example, which is in the news these days, very controversially, or Elena Arzak in San Sebastian, Spain. There has been, I guess it's called modernist cooking. This idea of very experimental, using chemistry almost. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to one of these restaurants. I have, actually. Not very often, but I have had that experience of going into a restaurant and being served foam or some kind of strange concoction. Like, it was like Pop Rocks, but they tasted like anchovies. Or I mean, I've had, like, these crazy... So that was kind of a trend in the, I don't know, 2010s, 20-teens, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. That's very much the Nouvelle Cuisine. You know, you can see the connection. Where things are going now, though, I mean, it's so interesting to think about. I'm not an expert on it since I'm basically a food historian, you know, effectively. I'm not like I have friends who are, you know, who write restaurant reviews or who are up to date on the latest restaurant news and so forth. And I'm not the person to ask about where it's all going. I'm more like, okay, where's my next story going to be? Where am I going to find a world where something interesting happened that I can try to bring to life in a novelistic way? I'm sorry, I feel like I'm a novelist manquee in some ways. Like, I want my books to feel like novels. So I'm always looking for a world where, in this case, you know, it's the early 1970s. So much is changing in the culture. You're a young man, a young woman in this, you know, Annie Devine and is one of my characters, or Michelle Girard, and they're opening their own restaurants, and how that felt and how exciting it was and what music was playing on the radio, all that kind of stuff. I want my books to feel novelistic in that way. So I'm always looking for a world that I can bring to life.
I know your book was just recently published, but do you have any back burner ideas coming up in the next couple of years or any other?
I have a new book I'm working on, yes.
Oh, nice. Congratulations.
Yeah, it's a whole different direction. It's going to be about sushi.
Oh my gosh, really?
So, yeah, it's a different. My wife is Japanese, and I spent a lot of time in Japan over the years, so I'm excited about this new book.
I'm excited to hear about it. My last question before you do your reading is, what was your favorite French cuisine that either you really want to try that you research in your book or when you were doing your interviews when you're in France, if you have one?
There's a restaurant in Paris called Guy Savoie, and it was I interviewed him for the book. He's the next generation after the Nouvelle Cuisine generation. But he's kind of like, you know, a little bit younger. And that lunch was just unbelievable, really, really remarkable. So yeah, there is still an incredible food to be had. The other thing I tracked down these women of the ARC, and one of them is still cooking today. She's in her 80s, in the north of France, in a town called Vervins. Mm-hmm. And I did this long trek, you know, on a train, on a bus, it was in November, raining. Got to this tiny little town where she has this beautiful little hotel and restaurant, and then she cooked me lunch, and then we sat down and ate together, and I interviewed her, and that was another very memorable lunch.
So sweet.
Yeah, she's great.
Thank you, Luke. If you want to read a little bit of your excerpt, and then...
Sure, yes. Okay, so this is just a short section about Michelle Girard. Michelle Girard was, you know, in a way, the most brilliant of these chefs, at least amongst themselves. They all said that, and he opened a restaurant called Le Pot au Feu on the outskirts of Paris. So this was not downtown, not in a hot area. This was like in the outskirts of town in a shabby neighborhood, a tiny little restaurant. And he was struggling to make ends meet. Listen, Michelle, you're a little prick, a petit con, de Levain called him affectionately, of course. I see you here and you're dying a slow death. But in the name of God, if you're going to die, at least die happy. Do what you truly want to do. He was talking about the food. Nothing wrong with a tiny, money-losing restaurant in a shabby neighborhood, as long as Girard was cooking what he wanted to cook. And De Levain was right. What did he have to lose? Girard had opened Le Pot au Feu because he'd wanted to be independent, because he'd wanted to express himself. Not just to cook, but to create. All around him, he could feel it. Change was in the air. It was generational. Everyone was experimenting in literature, in film, in theater, on campus. It was about more than politics or sex or drugs or rock and roll or any one particular thing. It was existential, a new thinking about how to live, a new disdain for authority. Girard was living with a friend, a sculptor, on a barge docked on the Seine, and he wanted to import some of the bohemian energy of the city to his restaurant. He just needed to figure out how to do it and also stay in business. No more sandwiches, Girard declared. I'm going to do what I want. Girard changed the menu that very week. He changed everything, aiming for a pared-down simplicity that was nevertheless exciting, new. His dishes had no heavy sauces or unnecessary ornamentation. He served his house-made foie gras totally plain. No aspic, no truffles, no parsley, nothing at all. It was a statement of purity and of his own tastes and preferences. His vegetables were undercooked by the standard measure, brightly colored and with a bite to them. His chicken and duck were served in intensely flavored reductions with a hint of vinegar and no cream, just the sort of dishes he served his friends. Everything on the new pot-au-feu menu was light, fresh, and a bit provocative. The point was to break free of the past. He had every respect for the traditional preparations handed down from Auguste Escoffier over the decades, but he wanted to simplify and purify his cooking, to focus in a radical way on the ingredients themselves, to find new and elegant combinations of flavors and textures, new interpretations of classic dishes. Classical cuisine could be lifeless, inert, and apathetic, thought Girard. He was determined to be stubborn and to reject the traditional authority and whatever existed before. And without quite realizing it, he had opened a new avenue, a new path, that of the chef as an artist of sorts, an inventor, an auteur.
Thank you so much for that.